Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Today, I will be talking with Christine Wiseman. She's the president of St. Xavier University in Chicago and the immediate past provost of Loyola University in Chicago, where she also held a tenured position as professor of law. Before joining Loyola in 2007, she served as vice president for academic affairs at Creighton University and associate vice president for academic affairs at Marquette University, where she was a member of its tenured law faculty for 22 years. Earlier in her career, President Wiseman served as an assistant Wisconsin attorney general with the Criminal Appeals Division. In 1989, she received the Wisconsin Civil Liberties Union Volunteer Attorney of the Year Award for her seven-year pro bono representation of Texas death row inmate Billy Conn Gardner, who was executed in 1995. She was also recognized in 2000 as a woman of influence by the Wisconsin Business Journal, and in 2010, she was named as one of the most powerful and influential women in Illinois by the National Diversity Council. Prior to leaving Marquette University in 2002, she received the Spirit of the Law School Award for serving as a role model for a generation of Marquette lawyers. It is my pleasure to welcome you to Great Lives, President Wiseman.
Thank you, Cindy. It's very nice to be here with you.
I'd like to start out by asking you about your childhood and where you grew up.
Well, you know, I grew up on the south side of Milwaukee. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, which is no longer open. But at that time, it was an integrated school. We had students who were diverse, different ethnicities, different races, and we never thought anything about it. And I believe there were over 200 students in my graduating class. So coming here to the south side of Chicago was for me a measure of coming home.
Oh, that's great to hear. What about some of the key formative events in your childhood?
You know, I recall spending a great deal of time with my grandparents who were immigrants. My father built a home for them next door to us. They never really learned to read or write English. And I remember on Friday nights when I would come home from school, my job was always to go visit them and most notably to play cards with them and to keep my grandfather from yelling too loudly at my grandmother.
Wow. Well, that sounds like quite an interesting family environment. What about the most influential person in your childhood or young adult years, someone who really formed your character?
You know, I think I was educated in grade school and in high school by the Sisters of St. Francis. And at that time, of course, they were fairly young women. Many of them did not have advanced degrees, but they had a great deal of care about the students they were educating. And many were like me. They were the children of immigrants or the grandchildren of immigrants. In my neighborhood, we were mostly Polish, German, and Italian immigrant families. And so they understood the importance of education for children like me, whose parents perhaps were not well educated and who didn't know that there were, you know, other opportunities in life apart from what was available to you on the south side of Milwaukee. I remember not knowing that there was anything north of Wisconsin Avenue in downtown Milwaukee because you couldn't get there by bus. And my family only had one car. I think my driver's license was the last license I ever received. But we just didn't have those opportunities. And so I remember the sisters talking to us about measures of behavior and interacting with other people and thinking about what was ahead for us in our own lives and then giving us the confidence to pursue those opportunities or those dreams, even when our parents didn't think it was such a good idea.
So it sounds like they were very real role models for you in an important aspect, especially, well, both morally, but also in terms of academic and career aspirations.
They were. The other person, I think, who had a great deal of influence on me was my mother, whose father died when she was 7 years old. My grandmother was left with three children at the age of 31. And so my mother never had an opportunity to go on to college. And she always insisted that a college education was important. She would look at my sister and me and say that we needed to be able to take care of ourselves. And it probably was related to her own mother's experience having survived two husbands, that she didn't want us to be dependent on a husband as we, you know, as we grew up in our own lives. And she was, you know, fiercely concerned about that. The other interesting thing is a little story that I have. You know, my father was a very strong man. He was a very strong Italian man who didn't much understand Italian women who were not like my mother, that is, who stayed in the home and took care of things in the home. And when I told him I wanted to go to law school, he absolutely had no patience for that. He had no understanding of that. And sometimes, you know, things would happen, and my mother would know that those things had happened, and she would know, for example, that I was in the right. And I would look at her and I would say, "Mom, why don't you stick up for me? Why don't you stick up for me? Why don't you stick up for my sister and me? You know what happened." And she would look at me and she would say, "I will talk to your father later when he's had an opportunity to have dinner and calm down. There is no point in talking to him when he is agitated." Biggest, most important lesson I have ever learned.
Well, yeah, timing can be everything, can't it? Really, your mother had a real wisdom there. I'm curious, did your father ever come around to supporting your career aspirations, or was he always kind of resisting your goals?
Well, I have to confess that he didn't much like lawyers. He had a couple of friends who were lawyers. He didn't much like lawyers. I don't think he appreciated much of what we did. But it was funny because when I got married, at the conclusion of my own law school career, you know, we moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and I was working in the Attorney General's office. And my father would not hear of my retaining my own name, my retaining my birth name. I had to become Chris Wiseman. That was my husband's name. Later on, as he grew into his 80s, he would look at me and say, "You know, everybody knows you as Chris Wiseman. Nobody knows you as Chris Gymel, and my daughter is Chris Gymel."
Oh, that's a nice story, that he really was very proud of you, even if he hadn't been openly supportive.
And actually, you know, he was a very conservative man, as you might expect. He was a survivor of the D-Day invasion at Omaha Beach. I respected him a lot, although we didn't get along very much. And, you know, I think that he first really understood the significance of what I was doing when I was doing death row representation. And my experience for 7 years on death row and, you know, in Dallas, Texas, really caused him to reflect and rethink a lot of his positions and a lot of the judgments he had made about people.
The representation of the man on death row, Billy Conn Gardner, could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved representing him? I know this work was pro bono or unpaid, and it took 7 years, I believe, your mm-hmm. trips back and forth to Texas from mm-hmm. Wisconsin. Can you tell us about how you got involved and what you did?
Well, at the time, I was on the board of the ACLU of Wisconsin, and I was teaching criminal procedure. And so I was asked by a colleague of mine who'd been hired by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and he called me, and of course, Wisconsin does not have the death penalty, has not had the death penalty for, you know, many, many years. And he called me and said, "Chris, there's a crying need for death row representation in Texas, because once the prisoners had been convicted and were on death row, they would be subject to what we would call a warrant of execution. In other words, they would get a death date assigned to them. And many of them thought that they had lawyers because, of course, lawyers have represented them at trial and through direct appeal. But the right to counsel stopped after the case was finally decided on direct appeal. So many of them were sitting on death row, would get these writs of execution, have an execution date assigned, and have no lawyer. In the state of Texas at that time, didn't have a system, a public defender system that could accommodate that. And of course, Texas was doing more executions than anyone else. So I agreed to do the case. And it was quite interesting because when I went down to Texas for the first time, the word throughout the court system was that Billy Kahngartner had himself some high-paid Yankee lawyer, and she was going to represent him. It was quite interesting because as I walked into the courtroom was pretty well crowded, and everybody was interested in seeing this northern woman who was going to come down and do death penalty representation and defend Billy Kahngartner. But you know, the whole idea, that concept of treating people with dignity and professionalism, it was even evident down there. Billy Gardner's trial lawyer was less than effective. And as a matter of fact, I think he was practicing law out of his car or something because his office had burned. And the first time I subpoenaed him to explore the nature of his representation, you know, he told me that, he had seen Billy Gardner for hours and hours and many times before the selection of the death qualified jury. And at that time, you could only see a client in the walls unit on death row if you signed something they called the buff card. And Billy Gardner had told me that he had seen his lawyer only for 10 minutes before the selection of the jury. So I subpoenaed the buff cards. And what do you think the buff cards demonstrated? That he had, in fact, seen his lawyer for only 10 minutes before the selection of that death penalty jury, which is, of course, death qualified. And I remember walking in and into the evidentiary hearing, and a sheriff from Dallas County, who was known as the Angel of Death because he was the sheriff who transported the death row prisoners from the Walls Unit in Huntsville, Texas, to the Dallas County Courthouse, stopped me, put his hand on my shoulder, and said, "Mrs. Wiseman, I know you have to do what you gotta do, but Billy Kahngartner is scum, and it doesn't make any difference. He's good for something." And I said, "Thank you, Sheriff, but as you suggest, I have to do what I have to do." And then I went on to, in essence, cross-examine the trial lawyer. And that took the better part of a morning where the lawyer said, you know, "I have no independent recollection. I have no independent recollection. I have no independent recollection." Well, how often can you say that? And so when the hearing concluded that day, I walked out and that same sheriff stopped me. And he said, "Ms. Wiseman, I should never have said that to you. I had no right to say that, and I apologize." But it was that sort of thing. By the time we concluded the evidentiary hearing, the bailiff down there, who apparently did yodeling in her spare time, gave us a tape of her yodeling, which we listened to all the way back to the Dallas County Airport.
Wow, what a strange sort of introduction to a long process. And it sounds like your value of treating everyone with dignity was certainly apparent. And you won someone over early on who could see that the way you treated Billy Kahngartner still as a human being. So the sheriff even having that change of heart in just the course of the morning and understanding that he still deserved a certain amount of respect and dignity. Can you tell us a little bit about the process, the 7 years, and how often were you in Texas? How much interaction did you have with Mr. Gardner during this time?
I still have 2 binders full of his letters. I saved them. I have them. You know, I don't believe he has any surviving family at this moment, but I don't know that. But I couldn't part with them because it was such a history of how the death penalty worked in Dallas. And actually, I have to tell you that after reading the 3,000-page transcript, only 300 pages occupied the trial, the presentation of evidence. The other thousands of pages were in selecting a jury that would be death qualified or would be willing to mete out the death penalty if, in fact, they found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That inordinate disproportionality mm-hmm. between the time you would spend
right.
in trial and the time you would spend selecting the jury.
Right.
There were people who had not been questioned. There was evidence that had not been produced. You know, the client had never been subjected. He had organic brain damage, and he'd never been subjected to a psychiatric examination. We found out that at the age of 10, he had been injected with heroin by his uncle and his father at the time to make him a pliant drug runner.
Wow.
You know, when you do something like that to a 10-year-old, you suspend their moral development. That's horrible, and it happens to people, and it happened to him. Now, to this day, I don't know. He did not match the physical description given by the victim, who died 11 days after the struggle over the weapon. It involved a, you know, a theft of cafeteria monies. That description never made its way into the evidence in any kind of a viable form that would have really persuaded a jury. So often these things are lost at trial. There's not much you can do on appeal because the presumption of innocence applies at trial. You know, it transfers the burden of proof and persuasion to the state. But once that person is convicted, that presumption of innocence, that, you know, transfer of the burden of persuasion and proof is gone. So, you know, it's much more difficult to right a wrong on appeal, if you will, or even in post-conviction relief than it is at trial.
You must have gotten to know Mr. Gardner quite well, and the fact that he had no other family or very little family to support him, I would imagine, increased your commitment to him in the sense of just standing by him through this process.
He had a mother who was, you know, infirm, and he had a sister, and of course both of them believed in his innocence. I remember his mother barely able to walk, and she would come every day, and she would sit in that courtroom, you know, with her leg raised, and she would listen to the evidence. How very, very difficult. She was a very gentle woman. His sister was a very gentle woman. I think he had another brother, but I think that brother was also in prison. So, you know, it's very difficult in that situation. I used to think to myself, geez, I don't know people who have this kind of experience growing up. It was a different world. And frankly, there was nobody sitting on death row who was raised like I was. These were people who were very poor usually. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they had no resources to really extricate themselves from that situation.
Your comment, too, about how difficult for someone in those circumstances, especially you mentioned, you know, drug exposure as a young boy, brain damage, you know, how that suspends someone's ability to develop a moral core. You know, most of us assume that, yeah, given the circumstances in our lives, the sort of supports, the family that surround us, that we can develop a good sense of values. But of course, for some people, that's incredibly difficult. And as you mentioned, poverty is another thing that makes it so much harder for some people to have a strong sense of values. Or,
you know, poverty makes people vulnerable to disease, and disease makes people vulnerable economically. It makes people vulnerable politically. I think you see that across the world. You sometimes see that now with the, you know, evolution of the Ebola crisis. I mean, and why some of these people are also subject to invasion by, or occupation by, you know, different forces.
your experience with Mr. Gardner and the fact that he was eventually executed, how did that affect you? I'm sure you built quite a relationship with him over the 7 years that you would visit and work with him. I'm just wondering in what ways that might have changed you or marked you as a person.
Well, personally and professionally, I mean, you know, people would say to me, well, you didn't represent him at trial. You didn't do the offense. But professionally, you know, I was a pretty effective lawyer. That was what I did. I was an effective advocate. I was an effective teacher. I had been a prosecutor. And not to be able to convince another court with any measure of sustainability that, you know, there was a constitutional infirmity in his case that should have at the very least allowed him to be resentenced and to receive a sentence less than death, you know, I considered that. And I, for me, it was a professional failure, you know, whether or not other people would consider it, it was, you know, and personally, it was very difficult. But I look back on it now. And I have students who ask me now, who say, you know, President Wiseman, how could you have done that for 7 years when it wasn't really successful? And I look back and I say, well, you know, in some measures it was, because now we have DNA testing. We have people who are very conscious about things like cross-racial identification and the inaccuracy of eyewitness identification sometimes. We have people who are sensitive to these issues now who were not so sensitive to those issues in 1988. So much has happened. It's one grain of sand, you know. You make a difference one incident at a time, one student at a time, one client at a time, one case at a time. And so I look back on it and I say, you know, history is long.
I want to ask you a couple of other questions. Any thoughts about, I'm curious what keeps you motivated day to day? As you said, you've done a lot of different jobs in the past and you're now here running a large institution. What is it that kind of gets you out of bed every morning and makes you go to do the work you need to do?
You know, I don't know. I think I'm a person, I must have a lot of serotonin in my brain or something. But I'm a person whose glass is always half full, always half full. Oh, there are times when, you know, I have those conversations with God, as they say, where you sit down and you say, hey, look, even Job had an end to the trials, you know, don't forget about me here. But for the most part, you know, you come to the office and I'll see a student, I'll see a faculty member, I'll see a staff member who's smiling or doing something. And, you know, it's another day. It's another day. And I am confident, usually, that things will work out. That's kind of what kept me going to the end with Billy Conn Gardner. You know, I had a confident hope, let's say, that things would work out. They didn't work out the way I expected, but perhaps that doesn't mean they didn't work out. And from that, I have framed a sort of another truism. You make a decision at the time based on the best evidence you have, and you make that decision. Sometimes it doesn't turn out the way you expected, but that doesn't mean it wasn't the right decision to make.
That's a great observation. As you're saying that, I was just thinking about Mr. Gardner's mother and sister, who I'm sure drew enormous comfort from the fact that you were there and that you were doing everything you could, that you're willing to continue to travel back and forth and to walk with him through a very difficult process.
So, even to the end, you know, I still remember, talk about symbolism. I remember the night before a prisoner is executed, they take that prisoner to a special cell, and there are layers of grating so that you know, obviously can't pass things or anything to the prisoner. And I went that night, and it still, so many years later, causes me, you know, to choke up a little bit. And I remember he put his hand up on one side of the, you know, of the wall, which was a series of bars and glass, and I put my hand up on the other side. And he looked at me and he said, "Don't ever blame yourself for what will happen tomorrow." And tomorrow was 12:05 a.m., you know, and that's when he was executed. I was not there for the execution because my request to be there crossed in the mail, and he didn't want to subject me to that. Mm. He didn't want me to see him pass. But oddly enough, I was outside and the walls unit, and there's a catwalk, and it's lit. At 12:05, the lights flickered. 12:05 a.m. So it was
quite a symbolism. I'm thinking that he, even at the end of his life, was able to give you a gift.
Kind
that
of
gift
a,
of, you know, just sort of absolving you and letting you know that you meant so much to him.
And his way, I think that flickering light was kind of his way of, people read into situations what they need as well. And I looked at it and I said it was his way of saying farewell. It's kind of like, you know, when my grandmother died, and I thought that very night that I saw her at the foot of my bed. Who knows? Mm. Maybe I did. But, you know, that passing and was her final.
Sometimes I wonder if those kinds of things are happening all around us and we only tune in moments of special need, but that there's actually so many things that are part of our world and our existence, and that once in a while we actually stop and pay attention because something is happening that's so, so profound.
Well, frankly, that's the value of this program, to really talk about those moments. And I think to say to the audience that no matter who you are, and no matter where you are, or what stage of life you're in, or what position you hold, it's okay to pay attention to those special moments in your life as well.
Yeah, and I'm grateful to you for sharing so many of your stories. I think there's so much that, and I think of young people working here with students like you do, I think of them, and we focus so much on what major the student will choose and what career path they think they're interested in, but values are something that are just absolutely foundational. My final question, do you have any closing thoughts for us about living a great life?
You know, I don't. I think a great life is different for everyone, but I think you have to have some values that you maintain, because that's what sustains you in the really difficult moments. And there are really difficult moments in everyone's life.
Well, thank you very much, President Christine Wiseman.
And thank you. Oh. You've been delightful. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's our honor. Thank you again.
You've been listening to Your True North with Cindy Camp. The opinions expressed on today's episode are not necessarily those of WXAV 88.3 FM, St. Xavier University, or the producers of Your True North. For a copy of today's program, you can download it as a podcast by visiting yourtruenorthpodcasts.com. Thank you very much for listening to Your True North.